comments about anything? Yes.
The question about how he keeps that inspiration.
How Swami keeps that inspiration?
Does he stay in super consciousness? Is that how he manages it?
Well, I think a lot of the time. But part of it is just the sheer amount of energy he puts out. I mean, to keep that inspiration requires a continuous flow of energy. And I, you know, the little bit of work that I've done, I know that there just comes a point where you just, I was working on something recently, and I just didn't want to work on it anymore. I knew that it wasn't right, but I just didn't want to do it. And I tried to get away with it, and I didn't get away with it. But I could tell just in myself, I was just sick of it. And the answer just was eluding me, and I knew that I was going to have to put out more energy than I wanted to get the answer, and I just stopped. You know, and I know that Swami never does. Or if he does, he'll get up early the next morning and start again, you know. But he'll just keep going until absolutely every word or every note is exactly what it ought to be. I recall, I told you, some of you, this story, when he was writing the oratorio, he was staying in the house that we built, the guest house, and we were staying over at Crystal Hermitage in the construction site where they were building. And it's a matter of, it's about 2 minutes away from each other. And he telephoned one night, it was like about 2:30 in the morning. As it happened, we were up. But he called at 2:30 and he asked if I would just come over. So I went over and he was writing, "You Remain Our Friend." And he wanted to read me the verse. And so he read the verse, and he said, "Well, what do you think?" And it wasn't that good. And I said, I thought for a moment, I said, "Well, not every song will be your best song." Because I didn't know what to say. He said, "Thank you." And, you know, and by the next morning, he'd written what he kept. But you could just sort of, there was just sort of this look on his face, and he almost said it like, "I hope this is good enough." And he just, sort of because it was so late, he was a little tired, he just needed another consciousness to come in to tell him what he already knew, which is it wasn't. But it was, I mean, by anybody's standard, it was superb. It just wasn't as good as everything else he'd done. He knew it. He was pretty sure, but he needed somebody to confirm it. And nobody at that time, nobody else lived anywhere near there. So, you know, I was a person who could come over because we were right next door. Anyway, that was just like temptation. Nobody wouldn't give in. So it's being, how many times in this chapter does he talk about having the integrity not to do anything that you know is not absolutely consistent with your vision? And it really is a matter of integrity. When you work creatively, you really do feel it. You feel that you're betraying your own vision, but you'll say, "Oh, it's good enough." You know, you'll just say it. You'll say it right to yourself, "It's good enough." But he says emphatically, you must never do that. Because just doing it even once begins to diminish your power. Now, it's good enough sometimes if it's a brochure that has a shelf life of a month or something like that. Even, for example, the book that Swami's working on right now, he's writing it, he's writing it for Master. And he commented, I mean, I don't know how he could be more exacting than he is, but he said, "There's just simply no margin on this one because this is going out as Master's words." He said, "And there's just no margin for anything that isn't absolutely the best that I can possibly make it." And so it's an even more of an effort than usual. Just, is that thought crystal clear? Is that exactly the right word? It's really energy. It's energy directed in all the ways he said, calmly, from with willpower from here and love from the heart. You know, just in right attunement. And not just energy that's just emotion and frantic, but that's directed with that calm power. And that's where solutions come from. I mean, all the things which we will talk about that are in these chapters. Faith, patience, love. That's what he says. Robert, you had a question? Not anymore? Okay. Yes, Jack? I'm sorry, what did you say?
How much credit would you say is the actual appreciation of someone for a work? For the person, for the people who might potentially at least enjoy the work of art, whether it's music or fiction, to the total inspiration, the total value.
I missed the first part of the question. How important is what?
The actual audience, or the people who appreciate something of the art, the growth of the person who actually creates the art. Someone who creates a beautiful painting and it's never seen. Is there something, at least in his own lifetime, is there something missing there, or kind of a give and take that's part of an important part of the total inspiration, the total value of the work, at least in considering this person as an instrument?
I would actually, I would say no, and I would say the way Swami writes it. If you are genuinely in tune with a divine inspiration, your satisfaction is that experience. And quite secondarily what you create afterwards. And you do your little bit and it's good for you, but the reason you work so hard to make it perfect is because of the necessity to be a perfect channel. Then the more detached you are from what happens next, the more pure you are in your consciousness while you do it. Now, it would be only natural to feel enjoyment, or gratification, satisfaction, if you manage to communicate. And of course, Swamiji, there's another element, which is that Swamiji says, if you're not communicating, you have to at least reflect as to why that might be so, that you're not able to reach people. And depending on what level you're working on, what level your own consciousness is on, you may need that feedback to help you understand where you're not clear or where your technique needs help, whether either your consciousness or your technique needs help, if people aren't getting it. But you may also decide that if people aren't getting it, it has nothing to do with you, because you have received it and you have expressed it, and if they're not getting it, it's just the way things are. And you may really, in the best sense, you wouldn't care, because you would be so satisfied from the inspiration that you felt that anything else would be just coming down from that. So it's kind of a balance between the two. But there could be easily be a point in your own development as an artist where you would learn from people's responses. Now, learning from their responses is different than needing their responses in order to feel that you've done, to feel satisfied in yourself. Because, in fact, to the extent to which you are relying on anybody else, you're limited. Because they're just never going to come through for you. It's just crazy. And in fact, you can get very confused by what people say.
In terms of just one part of it, I understand what you're saying.
Uh-huh.
The inspiration that so many people felt through Swami's music.
Right.
It seems surely that that would be a way in which his own spirit would get buoyed along.
Well, he's earning good karma from that. He's doing exactly what God sent him here. But you see, Swami's satisfaction comes from doing what God asked him to do. And if God asks him to create, and then God wants people to be inspired, that's nice. But if God asks him to create and wants nobody to be inspired, that wouldn't matter, because Swami would still have to do it. Because he's doing it because God asked him to do it, not because Swami wants people to be inspired. It's the same as Mother Teresa helping the poor. Do you see the difference? But yeah, karmically for Swamiji, it's a real good thing. That's what he himself says earlier in the book. When you bring people down, you get that karma, and when you bring people up, you get that karma.
I just feel like with Swami, there's a lot of give and take, and as a generation, his inspirations have been generated in part through the energy exchange with so many people. Appreciated it on an invisible.
I don't necessarily agree, Jack. I don't necessarily think that's true. Now, on the other hand, I just told a story of him asking for my feedback, and he passes his writing out and he asks people to comment, and he often takes input. And so he is in an interactive process. But I don't know how dependent he is on that, really. And I don't really know really what real part that plays, whether he's just playing that out for our sake. Sometimes I think he's just doing that to train us to be able to perceive. That he could proceed anyway, but it's a good exercise for all of us, because that's part of his job, is to train us to be able to do these things. And so by letting us see his process, a lot of us have learned about how to do things.
Right. It's just seeing so many people impacted.
No, but Jack, you're...
Way, you probably thought, well, that's right, you know, because his interest is in helping people, especially uplifting the spiritual path, the spirit of altruism more.
Jack, I think that's not true. And I think it's very important that I keep saying that that's not true. He's human enough to feel satisfied. But in the ideal form, that's not why you're doing it. And if you're doing it because other people are responding to it, to that extent, you're going to be trapped by their reactions. And it will diminish your capacity to get pure inspiration because you will think about it. You will think about whether people are going to like this. And you will remember. Remember he tells that story about someone saying you write like Shakespeare? And then he wasn't able to write? Because all of a sudden, instead of thinking completely impersonally about the inspiration that was coming, he was trying to also think about how people would react. And that immediately diminished his freedom. Now, and that's why, see, what it really feels like is that once he's finished with it, he has no relationship to it. Really, he has no relationship to it. He himself looks at it and thinks, that was amazing. And he doesn't have any idea how he was able to do it. I mean, he talks about it in terms of when he's writing words, he can't imagine how he could ever write music. And he'll look at the music he's written and he'll have no idea how he wrote it. And then when he's writing music, he'll look at the books he's written and he'll think, I don't know how I ever was able to write those books. And so once they're done, it's just so impersonal. There is no sense that I, Kriyananda, have written this music and everybody's so excited about it and I feel good about it. It's not his. That's what he says over and over, this is not my music. That's why he laughed when he told that story when someone said, what's your favorite music? He said, mine. And then he realized that sounded so funny. But the funny part when he reflected is it's not my music. It's the music that has come through me. And it's his favorite. As he said, he didn't say it was the best. He just likes it the best because it was what God gave through him. And so he resonates with it. Because, I mean, I know myself, and whenever I'm doing creative work, if I'm thinking about whether people are going to like it or not, I'm just dead in the water. And it's one of the things that you have to... Now, I've also said, you know, you think about who you're communicating to, and you use that as a magnet to draw the inspiration through. But insofar as you're thinking about whether they like it, it's always corrupted. If you're singing and you think that people look like they're having a good time... If I'm speaking and I'm thinking that people look real inspired, you know, or asleep or whatever it is, completely warps it. You just can't do it.
Most of the highest inspiration is in thinking like Princeton's Donovan. Maybe he deliberately thought, well, this direction, if I go too far in this direction, I won't reach a broad audience. I won't attract a broad enough audience. And maybe he went to the more conventional lines and means of creating music then. For that reason, and Swami has in mind a certain consciousness that he wants to bring, draw his friends and his guru bhais up into, and then he thinks in terms of that, and then he's happy when he sees that.
I think it's more likely that...
It's not so much that, you know, like, he wants people to like him, but he wants
He's perfect. I mean, it's just what Mozart is in here. Remember when the publisher said, you're going to, you know, if you don't write music that people like better, you're going to starve. Mozart said, well, then I guess I'll have to starve. I can't write anything else. And every artist who's really true just writes what they can write. And they just do what they can do. And I think that's really what we're working with here. Okay? And I mean, that's the hidden message of art, is that you actually are putting across your own consciousness. And just, you know, Swami makes these things seem so simple, to be clear, to be patient, to have faith, and so on. But just this whole discussion about where does the ego fit into it is the whole question about whether you can do it or not. And this whole thing about how, he talks about how artists didn't used to go crazy, and then most recently they've started going crazy. You know, in the last so many centuries, they've started going crazy, where they never used to before, because all of a sudden there's been this great insertion into the process of this concept of I, the artist. And so when you start doing artistic things with any consciousness of I, the artist, especially if you have a lot of power, I mean, he describes it so well, if there's a lot of energy flowing through and there's a big block, there's a big break like that. And so people who have a lot of power have developed the karmic ability to generate a lot of power but haven't developed the purity of heart or the understanding of how dangerous it is to take that energy to oneself. I mean, people can fall into that without even thinking about it. Everybody just assumes that that's how you would feel. But great artists know. It's just as simple as that. Like Mozart said, this is the music that was given to me. It's the only music I can write. And Brahms says, the music that you think is simply not as great as the music you're given. So really great artists don't have to fight the impulse to be egoic, because it just doesn't occur to them, because their experience is so clearly that it's come from another source that you just are there enjoying it. That's all there is to it. You just enjoy it. And when it's finished, it's just gone. And if you hold it and savor it and contemplate it as your own, then you're trapped. And Swami makes a huge point in here. As soon as something is finished, you must let it go. It must always be a clean slate. Inspiration is ever new. Every moment is different. And that's, it's just, those are the disciplines that you find when you're doing creative work, that there's such a temptation to plug in what worked before. And that's where you have to put out new energy and not do that. And you have to put out discipline and not even remember. You know, just not even remember that you've done it before. Just approach it as if it's never been done before, and then see if you happen to move in exactly the same way, let it be because this moment resembles the other moment, not because it was a lower energy choice and I know I can just plug this in. I mean, you all understand that, because I know a lot of you do a lot of creative things and you can feel how that works. Does that make sense? Questions?
Make yourself transparent to the
transcendent. Yeah. Swami also talks about, I love at the very beginning, the first chapter we talk about when he's talking about clarity, and he talks about that there's two directions for creativity to go. One is expansive and one is contractive. And he uses it in this sense that creativity can go from your particular experience into some universal way of expressing that experience, or you can have your personal experience and draw it into a more and more just about your experience. You can see the universal threads in it, or you can see just the personal threads in it. In a very interesting way, I mean, Swami was talking about his own autobiography, The Path, and he said he didn't tell any stories about his life. He said there were so many stories he could have told, but he only told stories that in some way illustrated some universal principle or could be used to illustrate a universal principle. When a person writes an autobiography, so often what they're trying to communicate is, look at me. You know, look what my life was. Whereas his was not really to say, look at my life. His was to say, look at the life of a devotee. Look at the life of someone who could become a disciple. So every story that he included, he wanted it to have some message that would go beyond the scope of it just having happened to him. It's interesting because I have referred a number of times to this book about Georgia O'Keeffe, which I've enjoyed. I enjoyed quite a lot. But it was a good biography, but it was by no means a great book. And I don't know if the subject did not allow the book to be greater than it was, or if the author's choices left it that way. But I was reflecting how much information in that book was just gossip about her life. Now, of course, that's why it was written and that's why I was reading it. But so much of it just did not go any farther than her life experience. And there was no effort, moreover, on the part of the biographer to in any way be expansive in the creative way that he expressed this. It was really just all about her, and even almost an effort to particularize it and make it more about her. Do you see what I mean? And so as a consequence, I mean, I've loaned that book out and I've actually bought it and given it away a couple of times and I've read it more than once. At the same time, it's not that good a book. And it's not that good a book for exactly that reason, that it's just so much about her. Now, it sounds ridiculous. It's a biography after all, isn't it? But for example, I read the huge biography of Lincoln by Carl Sandburg. I don't think I read the entire thing, but I read a lot of it. And partly because the character is, you know, Abraham Lincoln was a great man. But also somehow the way it was written, it was always moving you to understand. Of course, Lincoln played a huge role in world history. And George O'Keefe painted pictures.